If you lived in a secret hideaway, rich people basement, underground thing, and you had to sneak into the people's fridge and kitchen to survive overnight, would you risk microwaving things?
I actually, a really weird thing about me is that I prefer cold food, so absolutely not. I'd consider it a feature, not a bug. Okay, you eat dry cereal, you fucking freak. You're not going to judge me, okay?
At least my cheese is melted. I'll say that. Fine, fine. You got me there. That's a bit of a checkmate, I'll say. I've been bested. Unfortunately, just like me, Steven Spielberg has also been bested. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Movies for Win Royal Rumble. Another entrant is approaching, and unfortunately that means we had to discard one of our original four directors that were in the Royal Rumble. Holy crap. Steven Spielberg, what a loss. But as illustrated on a recent Instagram post, Steven Kubrick threw him over the top rope, and away he went. That was very good work by you, I gotta say.
Thank you. Yeah, I was really proud of that graphic and how well it turned out, to be honest.
I wanted to call it out. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, dude. If you guys don't go to our Instagram, I post a lot of shit on there. You guys should check it out. It's at Movies for When, and you can see most of my toy collection and some of our podcast graphics.
Yeah, every so often the content's relevant. So,
hey, we are a current events podcast. I do keep us in current events.
Yeah. We are a current events podcast. That's right. Any farewell words, kind words, as we say sayonara to old Stevie?
I think, unfortunately, one of the real unfair aspects of Steven Spielberg's reputation is that when he was standing in there with so many pretentious film people gods, I think he never stood a fucking chance against Kurosawa, against Kubrick, against Tarantino. I don't think most film people would really put Spielberg's work in the same category as those men, but we would, and we did. I would have loved to see him go a little bit further because I'm a big personal fan, but honestly, this was one where, like I said, every movie so far I've given a 50, so like, this was the one where it was like, I didn't think anyone should be eliminated, but someone had to go, so...
Yeah, we accidentally had too many heavy hitters, unfortunately.
Top what happens, heavy Royal Rumble.
Yeah, what happens when 50 Diesels are in the ring, you know? It's a tough look. This is a jobber-free sort of situation here. So, yeah, let's before we get into our next entrant, ding, 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 it's Bong Joon-ho. Mm. Holy crap. He didn't throw Spielberg out. Room was made for him. So we won't blame director Bong for anything that's happened. Told Steven. I'll say goodbye to Steven. So I'll get into it a little bit with what we've been watching. But yeah, unfortunately someone had to go. Now, Danny, speaking of what we've been watching, can you tell me what you've been watching? Because I know that a lot of it is going to be on theme with our Royal Rumble theme here. So please.
Yes.
Indulge me.
It is only on theme, in fact. I watched only pro wrestling and Parasite since our last recording. Basically, for those unaware, All Elite Wrestling just had a really big stadium show at Globe Life Field. It's basically let's call it the WrestleMania of wrestling, to throw shade at sports entertainment. It was really fucking cool, that. And because I'm a hardcore, I'm a true fan, and I'm also an insane person, and I've got the papers to prove it. I went to so many fucking live wrestling shows over the past couple weeks. I'm not going to go super in-depth. I'll just touch on them. I will say I did watch two wrestling-themed movies, so I'll make sure we do those first. As I said, I did watch Wrestle Massacre. I watched it with the Deadlock podcast commentary on, because I'm not going to sit and just watch that. That's basically watching like a wrestling Master Pancake theater of it. It was not quite Bill Z-Bub tier, but very close. A lot of pornographic imagery that made me uncomfortable for the women being filmed. You know what I'm saying? Mm. Like, I was like, this does not seem like a happy situation to see breast in. You know? Mm-hmm. What I was very surprised at was how many actual wrestlers were in this movie. I think a lot of people could have used a paycheck, and it had, like, a lot of, like, holy fucking shit, that guy's here? But Wrestle Massacre is basically not a movie. It's, like, that bad. Another one I watched, though, was No Holds Barred. Have you ever heard of No Holds Barred, Greg?
The phrase, yes. As a film, no, I have not.
So the movie is a 1989 film where basically Vince McMahon and Hulk Hogan were like, we should make a movie, brother, and just snorted a bunch of fucking coke and made a movie, essentially.
Who, them? Cocaine? Yeah. My heroes?
So, yeah, they were coked the fuck up, and you could tell from this movie. Hulk Hogan stars as the Rip. He's not the titular character. His character is just named Rip.
Mr. Bard himself.
Interestingly, if someone who did actually have an acting career is a dude named Tiny Lister. A real easy way to remember him is in The Dark Knight. He's the convict on the boat with the button, the really big dude.
Oh, yeah.
So he's the bad guy in this movie named Zeus. And what's interesting is that they, like, pretended this movie was a success, which it wasn't, and they had this dude come into WWF canon as Zeus from the movie and fight the real Hulk Hogan. But it's all weird. This is a movie that became a SummerSlam clusterfuck. All that goes to say, why I do recommend watching it is because for whatever reason, they got a fucking director of photography that was like, I'm going to photograph the dreamiest fucking 80s movie you have ever fucking seen. It all looks like a soft commercial you're remembering about glowing Diet Coke. Like, the whole movie looks like that. Visually, ooh, it was a very surprisingly pleasant experience for something that is, like, so undeniably just brain rot. Mm-hmm. Like, it is, like, real. We are dumber for having watched it, and I mean that. But the shows I went to AEW Dynamite and AEW Collision, weekly TV tapings at the Curtis Colwell Center. I even made some friends. Super cool vibes. I got some people's numbers. Nice. We text about wrestling now. That's awesome.
Hell yeah.
Man, then I went to StarCast, which was a basically one-day insane wrestling con where I had to be there at fucking 8 a.m. for the toy reveal panel.
Reveal. Ah, yeah. Okay.
Thankfully, I was like, these motherfuckers have better. Because, like, honestly, something that happened to TV is, like, if you waited long enough, Big Boom AJ from the fucking TikToks about Costco comes out. And I was like, that was not worth sitting through the boring parts after that. But, so, thankfully, when I got there at 7 fucking a.m., the reveal was that there was an event exclusive Kazuchika Okada, and Okada was there himself to talk about the figure. If you don't understand what that means, Okada is, like, the biggest fucking deal. It was, like, insane that this man walks into a fucking nerd con at 8 a.m. to talk about toys. Like, it was awesome. Mm-hmm. So, the whole convention ended up being a really fun experience. I did decide that based on my exhaustion and a compromise in bipolar management, I bailed on GCW Boss of All Bosses and went home to rest. And then we went to AEW All In, which was just the most badass fucking thing. I'm not going to touch on it because I said I'd be brief, and it is actually officially the longest wrestling pay-per-view in all of history.
No way.
Yeah, it was a banger all the way through. What I will say is that the Hangman Page arc is just hitting me in a way that is improving my mental health, and I fucking love pro wrestling. It was one of the coolest things I've ever done. I went with pretty much exclusively friends of the show. If you check the Instagram, a lot of people who have been on the show were there. I was surprised. I was like, actually, everyone I went with is kind of in some way connected to Movies for When. Like, they've either done something with us or something like that, and it was really cool, as someone who spent most of their life watching wrestling by themselves, to be like at a really big stadium show with like a large group of friends, and we were all super into it. And that was just like, I don't know, man, if you told me that was going to be happening in my mid 30s and I'd have a partner that was watching wrestling with me and shit, I would have been like, dude, that's impossible because heaven's not real. But boy, was I wrong. It exists, and it's called AW All In. Cherry on top with friend of the show, Ren. I drove to fucking Forney from Denton the next day, Greg. I drove to Forney to watch Tokyo Joshi Pro live in Dallas, and it was honestly probably the best show of the whole week. It was amazing. For those who don't know, Joshi is Japanese women's wrestling. This was actually like a Japanese company that was like in Texas, which was like, it was like a once in a lifetime type of thing. That's why I made the drive. And it was so much fucking fun. And, I recommend anyone check out Joshi Wrestling just because the costumes are so fucking glamorous. It's basically like a fucking J-pop music video, all the time. Like, I was watching the show and I was like, that locker room must have so much sparkly shit in it. Like, I can't imagine what all of these women in one place wearing these clothes is like. That's got to be so overstimulating. But they're these little 5'0" Japanese women, and they start training super young, and they wear the coolest fucking costumes, and nobody hits harder than these motherfuckers. Like, they beat the fucking shit out of each other. And they are also just so unbelievably good at the art form that is pro wrestling. And it had everything from like goofy fun with this like superhero character who like rode around on a bike, and like there was like silliness, there was lightheartedness, there was like badass fights. And the venue was perfect. It was at this place called the OC Theater in Forney. It was just it was a crazy good experience, and I thought I was like super done with wrestling, and I was like, if this was like, if I ever thought I would get to see this company again, I might just skip this, you know, like, but I went out with the sickos, Ren and Ernesto, and we had a really, really good time. And then I came home and I watched All In. I watched it, Greg.
Oh my God.
I watched it back after I was there live because I wanted to see how it came across on camera. I did it. I didn't watch the whole thing back. I just watched the really good parts.
Can't say I haven't done similar. Now, where you were sitting, were you kind of where the camera was pointing? Like, I know when they do stuff and they talk, they kind of look at the cameras. Were you kind of on that same side of things? Were you kind of on one of the other sides?
So I intentionally don't get camera side seats because they're a lot more expensive. And also, one, I don't really care to be on camera. Like, I'm not really interested in that. And two, you're usually not on camera anyways when you pay for those. So what
there's
I like to do,
there's my hat.
I like to sit facing straight towards the stage. It's like the camera side is the right side of the arena. I'm basically the center of the bowl facing the stage. And the camera's on the left side of the arena pointing right. So to me, not only are the tickets cheaper, but they're a lot better view because you can see the entrance from a head-on perspective. And for those who aren't aware, like, wrestling is basically drag where they fight at the end. The entrances are, you know, like, especially at like a major show like All In, the entrances are like something you want to see. And boy, did they deliver, dude. It was one of the best pro wrestling shows there's ever been. You probably could have shortened it a couple. I could think of some things here. It's not even matches. It's that all of the matches got a lot of time, which is really cool.
Yeah.
And another part of it is that WWE counter-programmed them by having a show start on Saturday night. This was a Saturday afternoon show, and WWE has been intentionally, like, counter-programming AEW. So letting it run into WWE start time was a fuck you. You know, like, and saying, like, these fans paid for our show, they're going to keep watching what they paid for. But I will say, there's just several matches that I think could have been, like, a short burst of fun that got, like, 15 to 20 minutes, you know, that I'm like, nah, you know, 8 to 10 with entrances would have been probably better pacing-wise, but all that goes to say, if your complaint is that there was too much good wrestling on the wrestling show you watched, what a great critique. You know, like, what a great critique to make of the product.
Yeah, like, are you actually complaining? Now, my only question is, was my friend Orange Cassidy there?
So, this is a really big bummer. He's out injured right now with a torn pec.
No.
There is kind of, AEW has its own little mini Royal Rumble called the Casino Gauntlet, and I really got my hopes up because they were distributing these unpunched sheets of Upper Deck trading cards for AEW. And the only person on a card that wasn't actually booked was Orange Cassidy. So I was like, ooh, am I getting a little spoiler? You know, like, is he on this all-in branded card because he's going to be here tonight? Sadly, my inference was incorrect. There was no Orange Cassidy, and he had a pectoral tear not all that long ago. Usually that's going to be a minute. So that was something that a lot of people were really hoping to see that unfortunately didn't happen.
Yeah, that's oh, he is still in the hospital, laying in his hospital bed, I'm sure, with sunglasses on.
Yeah, he's been allowed to leave for a long time, but he just got so comfy in the hospital bed, and he just is chilling. He's not getting up. He's Orange Cassidy.
There's nurses here, or whatever. Well, without further ado, this is that was good. I like when you have a full wrestling weekend, and I get to hear about it. I usually don't know what happened, but you are excited about it, and that makes me excited about it.
It's one of the things that makes me feel like I'm living a life, is every so often I get to do one of these, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And, yeah, the 41, that sounds cool as hell. I would like to go see those girls.
I think anyone who, like, seriously, I think if you like hate pro wrestling, I think you would have liked the TJPW show. Like, anyone would have had a good time at that show. They opened with a J-pop little song and dance. It was fucking awesome.
Hell yeah. Well, my my week was very different from yours.
Did you watch Prisoners?
Yeah, I watched Prisoners, followed by Come and See, and then capped it off with Ensemble and Polytechnique. So. I had a good time. I watched, unfortunately, due to a lack of really any free time, I only watched two things, and Denny, one of them was good. It's a documentary called Jaws at 50. It's on Hulu.
Oh, shit.
And it is I'll let you guess what it's about. It's about Jaws.
It's about Jaws, the James Bond character?
Yeah, exactly. 50 years of that guy. Who knew?
Wow.
That flew by suspiciously quickly. Speaking of our recently tossed out of the ring friend, Steven Spielberg, this a celebration of the original Jaws movie 50 years after the fact, and, you know, kind of going over its impact at the time, its impact now, both on, like, you know, modern filmmakers and oceanography as well. It's a very cool, interesting documentary. Lots of really cool footage of, like, 21-year-old Steven Spielberg. It's sick. Oh, man. Absolute baby. It's really cool. You're like, that guy's in charge of this production? It's sick. It's really cool. Yeah, it's, like, some never-before-seen. Well, I don't know about never-before-seen, but, you know, just, it's a good compilement? What am I trying to say? Composition of old footage and just, you know, cool interviews from, you know, if an actor or someone that was involved with the movie has since passed away, they interviewed one of their family members or somebody that knew them, that kind of thing. It's cool. I really like it. Hard to believe that movie's 50 years old. I watched one other thing, Denny.
What'd you watch?
I told myself, I saw this, it popped up on Peacock, and I said, okay, I've seen some good stuff about it. Denny said this sucks. It can't be as bad as Denny says, but Denny, I should have listened to you before I watched Drop.
Oh my god, dude, that was like, I could have told you, like, dude, sometimes I have like a fucking chip on my shoulder about a movie. This is not one of those times. Well, I also did, but like,
yeah, that didn't help.
Yeah, dude, Drop is seriously like, there's no way it's not going to be my pick for worst movie of the year. I can't imagine like a Madam Web event happening between now and the end of the year where something worse than Drop would come out.
I enjoyed my time watching Madam Web, and I think that's the key difference here.
Ah, good point. Good point.
The editing makes the movie unwatchable. Now, I watched it with my wife, and she's really not like watching the filmmaking kind of, she's just kind of along for the ride. She doesn't care about things like editing or, you know, whatever else, whatever you want to say, cinematography, this, that, and the other. She was like, why is the camera changing so much? I'm like, I'm glad you noticed. To quote my Critiker review, let me pull it up really quick because, yeah, it stuck out. Like, they just, there's like a, anytime there's a conversation, we're just, every single line is just switching between people. We're just switching, making cuts. So frustrating to watch. I said that Drop was the perfect metaphor for the gun held to the editor's head if they didn't have a cut every 5 seconds. There's a scene where it's the two people on a date and their waiter, and it's like, I think average shot length is maybe 1.5 seconds. It's impossible to follow. It's insane. It drove me insane. I hated that movie.
Bro.
And that's only half the issue. The dialogue. It's this brand of dialogue that I find so fucking annoying, where everyone's like, it just insists that everyone's super charming. It's just smarmy, smart-ass. Ugh. It's annoying. There was, like, a couple of cool things that I liked. Like, when they're in the restaurant and they're like, hey, you know, she's getting the messages and it's like, who could it be? Is it that guy in the corner? And, like, all the lights would dim and it would, like, have a spotlight on that person. And I thought that was cool. It was, like, cool stuff like that. But it's used to indicate to the audience that you should actually not turn off your brain and watch this schlock. You should actually be engaging your brain in thinking about these things and trying to solve the mystery yourself. And the more you think about this movie, the worse it gets. I don't want to spoil anything, but like 1.5 minutes of thought and I was just like, no, that doesn't make any sense, actually.
Why put more thought into it than the filmmakers, Greg? Like, that fucking reveal is one of the most, like, guy who served them coffee at the beginning did it reveals I've ever seen in my, like, I truly thought that, like, we had moved on as writers from doing twists like that. Like, I didn't think it happened anymore because everyone knows what a bad twist that is, and yet it's like,
and yet it's, bro, it's subverting the genre, Denny, by you saying like, well, surely they're not going to do something that stupid, and then they do it and it becomes a twist all over again.
It is, like...
genius. 4D chess.
The twist is that this is the studio that made Whiplash. And I like, seriously, like, Drop is what made me say, you know what? It's official. Blumhouse is a bad studio. Like, it was seriously, I was like, I don't care about fucking Whiplash. I don't care about The Invisible Man. Double fuck The Black Phone. Yeah. Twice over Barbarian's fucking corpse. Blumhouse is a bad studio. I'm done. I'm done with Blumhouse. Like, I will probably never voluntarily watch another Blumhouse movie as long as I live. Don't tell me they're making one of the Universal Monster revivals. I'll go.
I'll walk that back a little bit. Frankenstein walk that back. But yeah, the twist wasn't even the worst part of, like, the think about it segment. It's just like, why are we entrusting this whole plan on a girl that doesn't want anything to do with this? Anyways, whatever. One more positive. I'll end here on a positive. The guy that she is on a date with looks like a cross between Don Denham and Dylan Derryberry. It's very strange. Very handsome combination, I gotta say. Good looking guy.
We're gonna have to get their commentary on this. We're gonna need to get like a Don and Dylan watch drop, because I'm not watching it again. Like, no fucking way. Like, not I'm even not, for the podcast, no.
I'm not gonna ask those boys to watch the movie. I'll just have them look at pictures of that man.
Those boys are sadists. They'll watch it. They'll
do
it.
Oh, I know. If Dylan hasn't already seen it, I would be shocked.
Dylan will not only watch it, but Dylan will know some, like, unforeseen merit in it that I missed, I guarantee. Like, that's, like, he will have read the novel and, like, will under... Like, I promise, like, he would make me see, like, the beauty in it if we had him watch it.
Yeah, based on the novel, sure, yeah. I'm sure this is based on a book.
The novelization of a movie about texting. It's just the narrating texting to each
other. From the twisted TikTok account.
She typed quickly on her phone.
Oh, God.
The twisted TikTok account that brought you. The novelization of... My old bit was that I was trying to write the novelization of Christian Mingle the movie, because I wanted to make... a novel based on a movie, based on a dating website, based on a religion. I thought that was like the most up its own ass a concept could get, was if I wrote the novelization of it, but I would have that kind of commitment. I didn't write it.
That's too bad. Great, now I want to.
We gotta do Christian Mingle the movie one day, dude. That's like Denny and Greg lore from way back.
Is Gretchen Wieners in that one?
Gretchen Wieners, Arrested Development, Mexico Sets, Steak and Cake.
Yeah, oh my God. All right, I'll save it for the episode. I forgot about all that. It's fucking fantastic.
Legendary Christian movie. Like, doesn't get discussed enough. Like, legendary Christian movie.
Yeah, it's rare that you would get something of that specific quality and not have it be about Christmas.
Bro, I don't think any insane Christian could possibly be offended by you making fun of Christian Mingle the movie. Like, no. I don't think any Bible-believing Christian could be like, this is about my faith. It is serious.
The only person the only person that would not be on our side is probably Gretchen Wieners.
Gretchen Wieners was like, I'm down for anything if the check clears, I promise you. Like, that's why she's in that movie, I promise.
And she still is, God bless her heart. Well, Denny, speaking of people that are just in it and willing to do anything for a paycheck, are you ready to get into our movie of the week, Parasite?
With every day that you father your son, you become even better at smooth segues. Like, your segue game has just been out of control recently. I'm in awe.
It's all about transitioning what's going on into what I want the other person to do, which usually is just stop rolling around and let me change your diaper. Or... eat dinner. That's it. it's not a one-to-one, but those wires in my brain are starting to form those pathways that kind of build off, and yeah, that's why the segue game is so strong lately. Mm-hmm. All right, Denny, Parasite. I'm excited. I was thrilled. We knew we were going to do Bong Joon-ho. Mm-hmm. We tossed around the idea of doing Mother, but we landed on Parasite. It was just kind of an undeniable thing. But I do wish people... And we already did Memories of Murder. That was the other issue.
Right.
People should watch Mother. That's all I'm going to say. But Parasite...
really good. But it's like... really good. I'm not going to be honest with you, actually. I like Mother better than Parasite. But I like them both a whole fucking lot. Like, don't... You know, ooh, like, that's not like some, like, scalding hot take. I really, really like both movies. But, yeah, dude. Parasite is just, like... honestly... once this became, like, we're doing, like, a who's who of directors and their definitive work unless otherwise covered previously on Movies for One. You know, like, then it became, it was just like,
yeah,
then it's got to be Parasite for Bong Joon-ho. That's his biggest heavy hitter title that most people are familiar with that hasn't been covered yet, I would say.
That's right. Now, folks, you can watch Parasite from 2019. It's on HBO Max now. I think it was recently on Peacock. That's what I had in my notes, but I recently just saw that it is on HBO Max now. But I, of course, watched it on my Blu-ray. I have. One of my favorite things about this theme, too, is like, oh, I have a physical copy of this movie and this movie and this movie. It's great fun. Yeah. Parasite, we'll get into it. I'll kick us off with a couple. I have two critical reviews of the week for
Doubled
us.
Doubled up.
Just two one-liners that I couldn't, you know, I couldn't say no to either. Now, user number one gave the movie a 93 out of 100 and said, now that's what I call a hit from Bong. Zing, zing, zing.
Wonderful.
Had to include it. And the other user gave it a 95 out of 100. All I have to bring to the table is that guy goes a little too far down on his banana bites.
Oh my god.
Oh shit. Now Danny, I'll I wanna get into notes like right off the bat, but quick plot synopsis, I guess. Parasite is a movie about a family of schemers and bullshitters that are just living in a basement under a building in the poor part of town in Korea, and through a friendly connection, one by one, the family members gain employment directly for a rich family on the rich side of town. Starts with the son tutoring the daughter, and then, I think the other kid needs an art therapist. And then we get the sister, and then, oh shoot, it looks like we can get the driver fired to bring dad along to be the dad's driver. One by one, the family members are just siphoning negligible amounts of wealth from this family, and can't be revealed that they know each other, all this, that, and the other. It's, it won Best Picture, of course, in the 2020 Oscars, and I'm assuming if you're listening to this podcast that you have seen the movie, so I won't waste too much of your time on it. A lot of stuff happens, it's really cool, and I described the plot of the first half of the movie, and then the movie changes halfway through the movie, and it doesn't lose steam, and it's incredible. Yeah. Hell yeah. Denny, when was the first time you watched Parasite?
In theaters.
How many times have you seen it since?
This was my second watch ever. I saw it in theaters and that was it.
No kidding.
Yeah, yeah. Man, this was... that's why, because it was 2020. Shit was closed down, right?
Well, it came out in 2019.
Maybe not then. Okay. Yeah. I just know at that time the DFW Alamo Drafthouse Network was not what it is now in terms of screenings, and so everyone
or existing theaters.
Yeah, true. Yeah, everyone was talking about this movie, and I was like, okay, I really want to see it, but it's not coming on at any, like, it's not even coming on at, like, you know, Dallas Alamos, some that get bigger stuff. And I got really pissed because a trailer was like, you think it's one movie, but halfway through the movie, it completely becomes another movie. And I was like, why would you fucking tell me that? Like, I was like, so
right?
Fucking mad about it. So it definitely made me like, I initially was going to wait just until it came out like streaming or at the time I was probably waiting for Blu-ray, honestly. I ended up going to like a morning screening at the Angelica. Like, that's what I had to resort to.
Ooh.
In order to see it. You know, Vanessa and I went. The Angelica is not necessarily our scene. That's an independent cinema around here, but it's in a really bougie part of Plano, for those who don't know.
That is, if you want to know the vibe of the Angelica, just picture a very skinny 65-year-old man wearing a turtleneck under a blazer.
God, that's
and
good. Woody Allen, right? Larry David.
Comically large glasses, dead silent throughout the whole film. It's actually pretty nice of them. So
like, it was one of those things where, like, getting up and, like, driving on 35 early on a weekend morning was not something that put us in a good mood. And, like, I got there and I remember, like, we got a cocktail, but it's a long movie. So I got that weird little mini hangover you get when you, like, drink a cocktail but don't keep drinking and it's like 11 a.m. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm talking about? Yes. And so I do remember specifically that I was like, this is a really good movie, but I am not in a good mood while I am watching this movie. You know, like that was kind of my experience with it. And
and that's the only time you saw it?
That's the only time I saw it.
Only other time I saw it?
Yeah.
You saw it? Bam.
And yeah, I mean, I really liked it. I do think I was already pretty radicalized when I saw it, and I think for a lot of people, some of this dialogue was a newer introduction to their like zeitgeist. I didn't feel as blown away by the themes as a lot of people, but I just, for whatever reason, I think whenever I've been like wanting to watch Bong Joon-ho, I've been wanting to watch something I haven't seen yet, you know, like, and he's got a pretty extensive catalog at this point. So this is my second watch, and I definitely raised my score on a second watch. Definitely was able to hear the music, as they say, a little bit better on a second watch, and we'll get into that. What about you, though? What's your relationship?
Yeah, good music in this movie, too. Yeah, I think I would have seen it a few months after you. I watched it in... Well, I checked, because I got the Blu-ray... after our good friends, the Sheltons, said, wow, you should check out this new movie, Parasite. It's very good. Here's kind of what it's about. And I said, okay, I'll check it out. Did not seek anything out. Didn't see a trailer, which it sounds like that's very good for me that I didn't see a trailer. Because holy shit, that would have ruined a lot of the experience for me. This is one of those movies I finally got to... I love it when it happens. It doesn't happen often, but when I go into a movie just completely blind... It's one of my favorite things. Even if the movie's like a B minus, whatever. Mm-hmm. The fact that I got to see something without having any prior knowledge is an insanely fun experience. I really like it. It's just almost impossible to obtain said experience, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like it had already run in theaters and I picked up the Blu-ray just trusting their word that it was a good movie. Mm-hmm. And then a month later it won Best Picture. And I was just completely ecstatic. I watched it.
That was cool when that happened, dude. That was really cool.
Like, I was like, holy shit, they got it right.
Yep.
Yeah, I think this might have been my fourth time watching it. I think I watched it when I first got it, and then after the Oscars, maybe a couple months after the Oscars, and then a couple years ago, and then this time I watched it again. Typing something out real quick, 1 second. Alright, now we talked a little bit about how this is kind of the undeniable hit of Bong Joon. I'll say, like, the only other Bong Joon-ho movie I had seen up until that point, I think, was Snowpiercer. I can't remember if I've seen anything else of his up until that point.
Still haven't seen it. Always forget about it.
It's good. I like it. It's a good movie. Great, Tilda Swinton. Great Tilda Swinton performance.
Ooh, I mean, are there any non-great Tilda Swinton performances?
No. There's your answer. She's the GOAT. Yeah, this was actually a recent bit of news that the New York Times posted their top 100 movies of the century so far. So everything released from 2000 to 2024. And the way they kind of ran it was asking... filmmakers, actors, a bunch of different people, like, what are their top 10 movies from that time frame, and just kind of scoring that list, basically, to kind of give a top 100 list of, you know, movies from the quarter century so far. It was really cool. And number one, resounding number one, was in fact Parasite. That was the top movie of the century, according to the New York Times and people that contributed to that. It's sick. It resonated extremely well with basically everybody. That's another reason I'm glad we covered this. I made my own top 100 movie list for the quarter century that I posted on Letterboxd. I've created a Letterboxd account to make my own list, and that's it.
It's maybe fun. It's a blast.
Who would you honestly trust, folks? The New York Times or your good friend Greg from Movies for When?
I would trust Greg. Like, seriously.
That's right. Yeah, maybe we'll share that list or something. You'll never guess what I had at number one. So, oh man. So yeah, That's really all I had to say. Are you surprised to hear that it made number one for best movie of the century so far?
No, but I do think I do think that affects my opinion of the movie, because I do think I don't understand, like, why this movie and not other Bong Joon-ho movies. You know, like, I'm like, they're all, like, pretty fucking incredible, and I don't know. Like, I really like Parasite. It's really good. If you asked me to name my, like, number one movie of the quarter century, definitely not Parasite. But I love it. You know, like, it's one of those things where I'm like, I feel like it's just a little too overhyped, and I'm like, why don't we all calm down a little bit? I don't know. Maybe I'm just weird. I also saw it when I was in a weird mood. It could just be that.
I had Parasite at my 13th spot.
Okay.
I had it at my 13th spot. So I had to check on that real quick. I think the real, like, kind of the motivation behind it, like, a couple of his other movies did make the list too, but not Mother. It's less popular. Like, this
underrated.
This won Best Picture. Like, it won a whole bunch of Oscars. And, you know, that's going to be a lot of people's entry point, and therefore probably their favorite. Sure. Of a person's filmography. Now, you know, Snowpiercer, that, you know, that's got Captain America. That one's in English. That might resonate with people as well. But I think Parasite winning Best Picture is really what kind of pushes it over the edge. Like, pushes it to the forefront of people's minds when they think of a Bong Joon-ho movie.
Sure.
And
I also think it, like that was a year, and this is something that I think is really cool. I don't know why I had this negative spin on Parasite, but, like, that was a year and a time where I feel like class was starting to enter popular American cinema. Like, you would start seeing mm-hmm. stuff like something that was very interesting about the Joker movie was you were supposed to feel good mm-hmm. about these, like, Wall Street execs being, like, murdered. You know, like, you were supposed to like that. And I think a lot of people have an easy time liking that. And I think Parasite intersected with the American zeitgeist in a really good moment of, like, growing class awareness, because, like, that's not something we like to talk about as a people in this society. We like to pretend that there is no class and that this is a free country and the liberty rings and you can work your way up by your own merit and your bootstraps. And I think that over the last couple of decades, multiple generations have been confronted with insurmountable obstacles to transcending class like there haven't been in the past. And I think movies like this are really resonating with people as they're becoming, like, radicalized. Like, seriously, like, I think it's hitting a culture at the right time.
Yeah, it hit at the perfect time. So I won't stand by and blame the American or, you know, general global audience for being so high on this movie. Doesn't affect my score on it or take on it, but I do understand what you're feeling, in a sense. It's not something I can say, like, how dare you feel that way, but I just don't personally take it that way. I'm glad people are liking cool movies like that.
Yeah.
I will say. Like this. That, and we're talking about it now. It's this one. Where do we want to go with this? Do you have a note to kind of get us kicked off with, even though we're already kind of kicked off here?
I did not make a single note because I was watching intently. So let me just think of an impression, something that it leaves me with. What would you say is the genre of the first half and the genre of the second half? How would you describe those?
I would say kind of a heist movie in the first half, with a thriller interlude that leads into kind of a survival sort of movie.
Sure. Like survival horror.
Like a spy ending, I'll say. So, like, we start... Yeah, that's my answer. We started it as a heist movie. It becomes a thriller for about 10-15 minutes, and then it turns into a spy thriller. Mm-hmm. And then has a nice little epilogue. I think this is not a three-act movie, but, like, a two-part movie with an epilogue. That was kind of my my way to describe the kind of story structure of it.
I mean, if you're thinking structurally in story structure, if the midpoint is when things change for the protagonist, they learn something new or they encounter a circumstance that changes their perspective on their journey, you're not going to get a clear cut example of that for film school than this, you know, like this is like the best example I've ever seen of like the protagonist having the world they've always been in turned upside down, you know, like, and having to look at it in a new way. Man, it is really, this is such a discouraging movie.
Oh,
I mean, it's just like, it's about people who are never going to get out. And that is a reality for so many people. And that is applying to more and more people that in the, like, we're just stuck at a certain level economically and we're just never going to transcend it. You know, like I don't know how in the United States of America in 2025, how a young person with no job experience and no education is supposed to like get a job, earn money, and move out of their parents' house. Like, it's just like mathematically impossible for a young person to just like do that on their own without financial assistance. You can't make that kind of money because like living is so fucking expensive right now, dude. This is a movie that really understands that. This is a movie that like, man, I the epilogue is really what rings the most horrifying to me about the movie, other than that one moment where Dasong, is that the youngest kid's name? Dasong?
I think so, yeah.
When he sees the scary looking guy, I mean, like, that's like a shit a brick horror image. Like, Bong Joon-ho made me believe that a child would be traumatized because I feel like I shat like all over my couch in fear. That was so fucking scary.
Yeah, the first time you see that shot, and when you see it, you'll know what shot. But, like, yeah, the first time you see it, you're like, oh, it's so unnerving. Yeah, Dasong.
But it seems to be having, like, so much fun just essentially making fun of yuppies, and it's kind of like this, like, you know, like, lower-class camaraderie, working-class camaraderie of, like, haha, we're all in it together, we're all taking advantage of these rich idiots, and... The movie is, like, for real, like, in so many ways a comedy in those times. You know, like, it's just doing funny stuff, and you got little slice-of-life things here and there. And it makes being a poor family trying to get out of poverty seem affable, right? And then it's not affable. Then it's brutal, and I mean, ultimately what you see is that, like, the working class people are pitted against each other, right? Like, and that's...
Yeah.
That's reality.
And, like, the former housekeeper and the mom are, like, she's trying to call her sis. Like, They are trying to have that camaraderie, kind of force that camaraderie to, like, you know, bring each other, like, gain the upper hand or whatever else. But, yeah, you just, like... This sense of unattainability, like, even, but then they get into that. That's why I think it turns into a thriller. Like, the turn is not just like, oh, now we got to fight to sustain it. It's like, oh shit, this house is literally like, the foundation of this house is built on top of a poor person, basically.
Yeah.
Like, they're this, oh man, it feels like the house is just a monument of wealth. That's just built on top of the poor. It's up on a hill where it won't get flooded, for example. It's catching all the best sunlight. Like, the shot of the oldest son, Ki-woo, a.k.a. Kevin, when he, like, first goes through the front door and the camera, like, follows him up the stairs, and it's, like, the camera's almost pointed directly at the sun as he's, like, walking up the stairs and, like, looking at the yard and scoping out the house. It's just, like... It's a different world, almost, that he stepped into. It's great.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just this sense of unattainability. class disparagement is a pretty common theme with a lot of Korean cinema and a lot of director Bong's movies, but I think this movie does such a great job at making it not only feel the most relatable, but also any sort of quality being unattainable.
Yeah.
It does feel within reach. They do reach the top of the mountain. It takes the effort of all four family members to sit on top of the mountain, and they're there for a good hour or two before it comes crashing down. So, and it was, you know, then there's this kind of snap moment of realization that it really never was for them.
Yeah.
At all. The best they could do was pretend.
Right. And, like, I think what's so profoundly discouraging about, like, the final moments of the epilogue is it's, like, ultimately you're seeing Ki-woo think that he is dreaming about a positive future, right? A future where he lives a better life, a future where he's able to take care of his family in ways that they weren't able to take care of him. But really what you see as a viewer is he remains fixated on this house. This specific mm-hmm. house that is now built on his dad as the foundation, and he will just remain fixated on that wealth, essentially. He'll remain fixated right. on that thing that he will never have, and that's the harrowing snap back to reality after we see what is a... I think we're intentionally meant to wonder if it's his fantasy or if it's really happening. You know, like when we see, like, him and mom walking into the house and dad coming out of the basement out into the garden. I think we're intentionally meant to be not sure if that's reality, and then it makes it really fucking clear that it's not. And that just like breaks my heart.
Yeah. I was going to kind of end with the ending, of course, but
pardon me.
since we're here, I think he has traded in the viewing stone for the house. The concept of the viewing stone, it's this like very meditative concept of art. The viewing stone, you know what I'm talking about. It's this big rock that he carries around. Mm-hmm. He says it's very metaphorical. It's a viewing stone is basically excuse you.
Thank you.
Like a rock or some kind of something you find in nature that looks like either a landscape or an animal or a person. In this case, it's a rock that looks kind of like a mountain range. And, you know, Ki-woo is, like, staring at this thing, and he's so fixated on it and drawn to it. He's, like, he basically, his character lives with his head in the clouds. He's constantly looking at this rock and thinking of living in the mountains without necessarily saying it. He's just constantly thinking and dreaming of a better life. And, like I said, at the turn of the movie, where, you know, we're all drunk, sitting on the couch and everything, he's kind of like he's on top of the mountain at that point. He's kind of summited, and then he starts talking to the family like, I think I'm going to ask Dae-hai, the daughter that he's tutoring, to go out with me after, you know, she finishes school. And he's already starting to dream of a future, kind of fantasize beyond the mountain that he's sitting on top of. Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, like, the saddest scene in the movie, the saddest shot in the movie is they finally escape the house and they're going back to their own house in the rain and everything.
Excuse me.
And he's heading downstairs in the street in the pouring rain. He just kind of stops, slumps, and, like, looks at his shoes, and he's like ankle deep in flowing flood water. And he's realized, like, he's back on the ground. He's not on top of the mountain. He's no longer in the clouds. He is just, you know, down here in the wet, in the dirt. And then with the ending, I think he is trading in the stone for the house. There's a quick shot of him putting the stone back into a river. Mm-hmm. And that's why, like, yeah, it kind of double reinforces the fact that, yeah, this isn't him rescuing his dad and buying the house or whatever isn't really happening. You get a shot to kind of confirm that, but it's also, like, really communicating to you visually that this is just a fantasy of his.
Yeah.
So, that the viewing stone perplexed me the first couple times I watched it, but this time it really kind of started clicking a lot more.
I don't think I saw it quite in the fullness that you saw it, and I really, really like the perspective you just brought to it.
I thought of that while I was at work today. So
very cool. Very, very cool.
It took me a few tries. I'm proud of that one.
You know, I think I wanted to view him setting the stone into the water as letting go of this idea that wealth would happen, but that's obviously not what it is, right? But I think on a first view, I wanted to believe this character is reaching peace, and it's not a letting go, it's an exchange. You're absolutely right.
Right. And I think also, like, the stone is supposed to, like, be good luck and...
They said it's supposed to bring wealth, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's supposed to bring wealth, but yeah. I don't know. I just thought that was very interesting. I'm glad we brought it up when we did. I think that's one of the more interesting kind of like visual components of the movie. Speaking of visual components, Denny, this movie won some Oscars.
Sure.
But I think the one it deserved the most was Best Director.
Sure.
Which is a category that I just kind of, like, didn't understand up until that point. I was always just like, well, whoever makes the best picture should get best director, because they directed the best movie. It just makes sense. But watching this movie, how intentional everything is, how meticulously planned everything clearly is, how just everything in this movie is so intentional and created with such care that I'm like, oh, this is what great directing looks like. Mm-hmm. Now I get it. This is what it feels like. Did that stick out to you on, you know, first watch or the second watch? It through his filmography in general?
I mean, like, Bong Joon-ho is a fucking generational director. Like, you know, just like undeniably so. He is just a one of a kind. No one else is making movies like this man is making. No one else is doing what he's doing, and hasn't been on his level. I think it's something you actually already mentioned, but it's when he's first showing up into his new world. Vanessa and I both commented on how disorientingly it was shot, and yet how smoothly it was also shot. And then, like, it's also like you're moving in a circle, right? You're kind of wobbling in a circle, and then I catch that, like, we see these sprinklers, we see all these perfect little circles spinning, and we're in this disoriented unperfect circle. And it really is moments like that where I'm like, you know, there's a movie with a great story like Parasite, and then there's something that's not on the page of the script, like the way he chose to convey disorientation in that moment, the way he chose to convey it, when he could have just showed the character walking up to the house. That's how it is in most movies, right? And you might show how, like, big the house is, you know, and be like, wow, the house is so big, he's so small, and you would see stuff like that. But I've truly never seen just a continuous shot that made me feel disoriented in the way that one did. But, like, I had to hold together my disorientation. Like, I don't want everyone to know I'm high, so to speak, you know? That's, like, kind of how, like, compose yourself. This is all insane, but you've got to fucking act like you've been here right now, is what this character is feeling, right? Like, you've got to act like you belong in this place, but holy shit, you didn't think it was going to be this extravagant, you know? Like, that's... And that's all done without words. That's all done by pointing the camera in the right way. And yeah, that's direction.
Yeah, exactly. Like, every single camera movement in this movie and all his other movies, it all just feels so intentional. I know he storyboards the fuck out of his movies.
They look like he does, yeah.
Everything is perfectly planned out to, like, just... If I'm an actor in one of his movies, I'm very comfortable that, like, we know exactly what we're doing. And just kind of, here's what's going to happen. Play within this. That's got to be what it feels like. I think one of my other favorite shots and, like, kind of... I don't want to say director tricks, but, like, one of the decisions he makes is, you know, when they are folding all the pizza boxes towards the beginning, and the girl that comes and picks them up says, hey, you fucked up, like, a quarter of these. They're kind of negotiating with her to kind of get, like, a full payment. And... we follow the family out into the alley, the son's carrying the boxes to the van, and then we're just kind of centered on the pizza employee, and the camera just, like, crawls towards her for, like, the duration of the scene. And, like, as it goes, the conversation kind of goes from this sucks. Well, at least, you know, you're going to pay us something. And then the brother comes in, gets right next to her, and is just like, well, what if one of us was a part-time worker? And then the sister comes in, like, yeah, maybe something. Yeah, they just, like, all start kind of closing in, manipulating her. And the camera is, like, keeps this steady pace, getting closer and closer to her. And then, like, three of the four family members are just, like, shoulder to shoulder with her. And she's just kind of looking around like, yeah, I guess I should kind of pay you guys. It's, like, it's such a great... it's just such a great way to express so much doing so little.
Sure.
And it's just, like, creates this kind of sensation without you even really realizing it. It's the kind of movement and direction decision that, like, you don't really pick up on. It's not calling attention to itself. It just kind of is. It just, all of a sudden, it feels close. Wait, how did I get here? And she feels the character feels the same way. Like, wait, how did all you guys get, like, in my ear, basically, mm-hmm. about this? It's great. Oh, man.
Well, to your credit, I think I really feel like I get to know every single character in this movie in an intimate way. You know, and mm-hmm. that's a lot of moving parts to keep together. But, man, I think, like, if I could use one word to describe Bong Joon-ho as a director, it would be range. In the sense that, like, he makes all different kinds of movies. Dude never makes the same movie twice. And I think the most range he shows within one movie is mm-hmm. most definitely Parasite. Like, it's him kind of showcasing everything he can do. Like, really showing the world what he's made of, you know? And I think maybe that's why I like some of his other works more, because in some ways this is a highlight reel, and I like to spend more time with parts of his expertise. You know, like, I like to spend a little more intimate time in him doing a genre like Mother, you know?
Yeah, like a noir movie like Memories of Murder.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And this feels like the human highlight reel, as is often said in wrestling. Mm-hmm. I mean, he really is playing all the hits in this movie and just doing... I guess it's like... Can I really name another director who did so much in one film and took the time to make it all feel meaningful and feel intimate and make it feel mm-hmm. real? And, like, these are fully living, breathing people in these constantly changing tonal circumstances. You know, like, the people are consistent even though the tone changes. And off the top of my head, I can't really think of another director doing something like this in one film.
No, certainly not successfully.
Right.
And I will add, like, you mentioned having, like, a intimate kind of familiarity with all of the characters that are all schemers and liars.
Right.
That's crazy. It's like, there's two sides to these people, and there's two sides to this movie, and I feel intimately aware of every aspect of both.
Yeah.
That's great. That's, how do you do that? How do you write that? How do you visualize that? How do you execute that? It's so impressive.
Well, I think, you know, it really speaks to the direction that, I don't know even how deep into the discussion we are, but we haven't really discussed, like, the plot very much. You know, like, we're talking way more about the how than the what when we're discussing this movie.
Yeah, we've discussed the how and the themes and not really the kind of the meat of the story.
Right.
I will say, before we move off of filmmaking, there is a good video on YouTube that is from Thomas Flight, who I think in the movie only talks about the editing of this film. Very much worth checking out.
Cool.
I haven't watched that video since the last time I saw it, so it's been a few years. So I'm going to check that out again, because there's some really impressive editing techniques in this movie as well. Or just check out the special features on the Blu-ray. Whatever.
Yeah.
All right. Kind of the meat of the story, Denny. I gave you an answer. I don't think you really gave me an answer about the genre of the mm-hmm. two different parts of the movie.
So there's... The midpoint and the third act really introduce horror to me.
I wasn't ready to say it, but I'm glad you did.
I do think there's a lot of thriller in the mix too. Like, I think that I think you see horror in the sense that scenes scare you visually, both in like the Dasong sees a ghost scene, in the like there's a secret scary underworld you don't know about and you shouldn't feel as comfortable in your home as you do. And there's horror in the bloody climax, right? Like, but where I also really see the horror is thinking about how scared I would be under the table. And I also think that that also is the thriller element that you're talking about, is that is a thriller scene that makes me feel very scared. You know what I'm saying?
It's very, very tense, yeah.
Oh, I feel like, dude, this is like, sometimes I can't watch shows. Like, I basically, Always Sunny in Philadelphia, it took me a while to understand that, like, this is a world without consequences and you don't have to worry about what's going to happen to the characters. And it's just, like, the anxious oldest child in me that, like, while they are just, like, trashing the place while no one's home, I'm just like, you're going to get in trouble. You're going to get in trouble for this. Stop. Be more careful. Yeah. You're going to get in trouble. And so, like, I already was there with them from an, like, I was anxious and the characters weren't, and I was right to be anxious, you know, like, based on what ended up happening. And those are very tense and very scary, scary scenes for me. And I think you also see, like, the horror of, like, having a job is like, really driven home in the third act when they're, like, their home is flooded, they're living in a shelter, and they have to go to fucking work and pretend none of that is happening so these fucks can have a fucking racist birthday party. And they, like,
they have to go to work and be visibly reminded that they stink because of what happened.
Right. They smell bad. Yeah.
It's degrading.
No,
they have to bite two bullets.
They're humiliated and debased, and, like, I think you see the horror of, like, having a conversation with your boss where, like, you know, when they're in the headdresses and it's Park and what's the father's name?
They call him Mr. Kim.
Mr. Kim, right, yeah. And so they're in the headdresses and you see the horror of, like, your boss is being candid, and so you think, okay, I'll mirror that, I'll be candid back, and your boss is like, remember your fucking place, you know, like, they just, like, snap on you essentially. And, like, to me, that is a scene that, like, fits in the horror genre in the same way that, like, the real life Jason Voorhees is your boss's power over your livelihood, right? Like, so I really think in ways that are not visually traditionally horror, I do think the content of those scenes is very, like, it's meant to make the audience feel afraid. It certainly makes me feel afraid. And so, yeah, I guess my take is that the second half, I would agree with what you said with there's elements of horror sprinkled throughout and twisted upon. The first half, seriously, you said heist movie, and I think that's fair, but I would say a really, really lighthearted heist movie. Like, it seriously like,
it's
a comedy. Like, some of the, like, the yuppie characters are so unbelievably stupid. Like, they're just, like, so dumb and so, like, easy to fool and easy to con. And it's just, like, it's funny. Like, a lot of it is really funny.
Like, they're oblivious and gullible, and it's just a treat. And it's filmed in a way that knows that it is a delight to watch them being taken advantage of in this
way. Right.
Oh, it's so great.
Yeah, man. Yeah. But, like, I mean, like, they described the, like, smell of being on a bus, you know, and I'm like, poverty in America smells like dirt and cigarettes, and we all know, like, when we smell it on ourselves and when we smell it elsewhere. And I really think they made use of something that is really, like, movies can't make you smell something, you know, like, that's like a really hard thing to convey in a movie is how something smells, because that's just not a sensory experience they can transmit to you easily. And I think if you really think about it, you really don't see a lot of, like, movie and TV content centered around the smells of things. If you really think about it, it's really not common.
There's a reason this isn't explored. It's because it's damn near impossible to make your point come across.
But he like created a reason why the character would be vividly describing the smell. Because usually you like that'd be so like, oh, that smells. Oh, it smells like a little bit like rotten eggs and a little bit like honey mustard. You know, like you wouldn't if you smelled a bad smell, you wouldn't break down the science of the bad smell. But they have a reason why the character is doing that for the audience. And then what we don't smell is the smell, but what we do see is we see him sniff. Right. Mm-hmm. That is the thing that pushes our Mr. Kim over the edge, is that he sees him taking a whiff. Smelling the poverty on him. And dude, like, to drive home the point, Trainspotting is obviously the first in this category, but this was a very disgusting toilet scene in a movie.
Oh my god.
Oh, it was a really nasty, disgust. And it's just like, you see the characters just be like, it's whatever, I'm in water and sewage. I've got nowhere else to go. And they just, like, resolve themselves to it of, like, yeah, my house is full of, like, raw sewage, and the only other place to go is more raw sewage, essentially. You know, like, you just see them resign, like, just give in to it. And it's just, like...
I could either be waist deep in it or go out and be chest deep in it.
Right. Yeah. It's so just dehumanizing. And, like... I'm a very uncultured person. My partner is a world traveler. What she was telling me is that, like, people will go their whole lives without going that low, like, physically low into Korean cities. That, like, that really is, like, we're seeing people at the bottom of the bottom. And something else that she pointed out. So in a lot of Asian culture... Something that I don't know if it's quite equivalent to the middle finger, but something very disrespectful to do is to point the bottom of your foot at someone, because your foot is the lowest part of your body. And it's basically a way to say, like, you are lower than the lowest of me, to point the bottom of your foot at someone. And, like, if you were, like, laying on the ground comfortable in a house, people would walk around you. They wouldn't, like, step over you, because that would be very disrespectful to you, to step over you with even over your legs, you know, like...
Right.
And you see the rich yuppie mom with her bare feet on the seat of Mr. Kim's car, pointing her bare feet right at him, and it's just, like... That's something that Vanessa made a note to be like, hey, that's something that we may not... Like, obviously, that looks, like, disrespectful in American culture to put your stinky feet by someone's head, but it is, like, a... It was a very big transgression culturally that is just, like... And it's also on theme with the lowness of them, like, the physical lowness, the metaphorical lowness of their class, and... God, man. Eat the rich.
Her audacity in the scene to not only do that, but then roll down the window because she smells him.
It's
again,
your
stinky, she smells
ass him. Fucking feet, bitch.
No, she smells.
I know.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, I kind of wanted a little bit more perspective on the cultural side of things. I'm glad she was able to provide that, a little bit of that for us.
I'm giving you a telephone game of the cultural context. Ask Vanessa directly for good answers.
No, the bottom of the feet is a good thing, Danny. You're fucking it up.
I'm not that bad, but I do miss a lot of subtleties sometimes when I'm trying to, like, repeat what she's conveyed to me.
Yeah, and that's fine. Hey. Some stuff we're just never going to understand. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how I feel about this movie and some of his other movies and just Korean cinema in general. There are a lot of subtleties that you and I, as white Americans, are never going to understand.
I mean, they're not meant for
us. And that's okay.
They're not meant for us to understand. We're just used to that.
Exactly. I'm going to pick up on the stuff I can pick up on and celebrate those things. So, I feel like we did, you know, pretty well. Mm-hmm. A lot of the themes are on the nose, so it's, you know, or in the nose, because they stinky. So, yeah, I don't think we're, you know, offering an incomplete sort of analysis of the film by, you know,
well,
not having too much. But every little bit helps.
I'm realizing right now that, like, this movie, I can finally rank along Fight Club with, like, I could just ask anyone, Fight Club or Parasite, I could be like, tell me the meaning of this movie, and I would completely judge their personality based on what they said. And it also rules out a lot of personalities I don't want to interact with. And I know that, like, I definitely saw some takes on this that it was, like, in defense of Park, like, he didn't deserve to be exploited. And it's like, fuck Park, fuck this whole family, they're all pieces of shit. I have lived and operated in that world. I was born in that fucking world. And let me tell you, the thing that this movie got really wrong is, like, they should have made the family love each other way less. Like, they were way too, they were way too meaningful. Their lives were full of meaning. And I can tell you that this world of opulence and this world of excess is a very, very empty, empty world. Hence the excess. But people are trying to buy yachts to fill the hole where their kids were supposed to go, but they didn't raise their kids. They worked instead. And if anything, I thought that the family seemed too loving towards each other at times, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I completely buy that. I completely understand. I have no words against what you just said. I do love the insight. I don't know. I'm somewhere in the middle with you, and that I feel like I do enjoy that they do love each other, but that doesn't make me ready to defend any of their actions or attitudes or treatments towards people lower than them.
Right.
They may seem friendly with the people that they are employing, but it really is kind of out of a place of necessity. They're never going to be part of the family.
No way.
I think it's kind of tough that they are showing and expressing so much love for one another, but just kind of like a surface level, you know, thanks for taking care of the dishes kind of for the people that work for them and are honestly closer with their kids than they are.
Right. Oh, infinitely so. Sequences. And like, Park has this bullshit spiel with his elitism about, like, crossing the line and how he hates people who cross the line. And that doesn't even fucking mean anything. Basically, crossing the line for him is, like, if he decides that you've, like, upset the order of things, so to speak. And that can be anything that he feels was upsetting to the order of things. And he's just such a, like, fucking cunt, dude. I was so fucking happy to see him die.
Yeah, he... Yeah, I think it's something that I made a note of, and I didn't really know how to kind of work it into the conversation, but I think this is a good spot for it. It's not until after the flood that we see the Mr. and Mrs. Park's, like, master bedroom and gigantic walk-in closet. As the audience, we've kind of crossed the line without their awareness, and we're seeing what's on the other side of that line, and it's kind of shown as being a whole lot of more nothing, like, oh, it's just a bigger bed, like, we're kind of cutting between the family on cots in the gym receiving calls and, like, to come into work, and they're digging through dry clothes that are being thrown off a gym stage to them while on the phone with a woman in a closet the size of the room that I'm in right now. Like, what's on the other side of the line is just more emptiness, but they have so much value in that,
right?
And they see that as such, like, an untouchable thing that makes them special. Right. it just irks me a little bit more.
Well, it's the egocentricism of it all, and it's what makes them so easy to manipulate, is their egos are so big you can grab them and steer. And you can tell them that their son is special, and they'll be like, I know, because I'm special, and everything in my life is special. When in reality, they're very insulated and very stupid and could very easily verify all this shit that they're being schemed on, but they don't even bother to do it because they're that fucking arrogant. They don't think that they're the type of person who could be fooled, so they assume they're not fooled, you know?
Yeah. Oh, exactly. They are... It's a conversation that they have when they're all, you know, drunk and hanging out on the couch. It's just like, they do feel that the family is very nice. They do feel they're very nice to them. And I think someone makes the point that, like, oh, they're just nice because they're rich.
And it's, they're kind of going back and forth. Like, rich is what I think she said. Like, Yeah, dude, if I wasn't so fucking miserable because of how poor I am, I'd be nice too. Like, yeah, fair point.
I think, and they do project a certain sort of niceness, but I think the parks are nice because they're oblivious.
Yeah.
They do think because they are among the haves, they have so many things that they just, like, because these people are here to service, they do so, like, without, you know, any sort of personhood.
Yeah.
They do what we say because we say so. And they are just oblivious to the fact that anything could be different. They've never had to... I know, it's visually, like, summed up in the scene with the kid in the tent and the husband and wife waking up on the couch, and then Mr. Kim is, like, trying to crawl towards the staircase and is just, like, frozen still, and you see his feet.
Oh, my God. That's kind of illuminated. Fucking shot, dude. The feet, that's a horror moment for me, is those feet being visible. Like, that's horror for me. But, like...
Ratcheted up the intensity, yeah.
But, I really think this movie... it really highlights that at a certain point in class disparity, rich people and poor people are like a different species that don't really understand each other anymore because their worlds are like so insanely different. And it's like, it's Lucille Bluth being like, what could a banana cost? $10? You know, like it's like rich people
Pretty close now.
Sure. <Yeah. laughs> At the time, that was an insane statement. But it's, or what's it, fucking Alec Baldwin on 30 Rock. Jack Donaghy being like,
Jack Donaghy,
listen, yeah. Lemon, you go get a gallon of milk and it cost what? I don't know, $500? Like, and this movie just shows that, like, when the disparity is that big between a rich person and a poor person, how could they possibly have empathy and understanding for each other? They're almost like a completely different species that doesn't really relate to each other than, like, you shit, sleep, and breathe, and fuck. You know, like, other than that, they really don't have a lot in common, to the point that, like, they're having this impromptu... Like, it literally is this, dude. It is that our family that we're following, I don't even know their surname, but they... Their world is ruined and their life is flooded and they are living at a fucking shelter versus the wealthy family had their camping trip rained out. That's the same storm, right? You know, the same storm. Mm-hmm. And it affected them so differently that the circumstance is so, so fucking different that, like, literally the next day this family's like, oh, okay, so no camping trip. We got to do something. How about an opera singer birthday party with full costume cosplay and literally everyone we know will be... And it's just like... So to put things in perspective, as much as I love All Elite Wrestling... so the pro wrestling landscape was miserable for about 20 years because there was a monopoly by WWE and they fucking sucked through that time. It was so bad. It was so miserable to be a pro wrestling fan. And the reason that changed was because a billionaire wanted it to. There really is all... like, and he found, like, the right talent in AEW at the right time, and they were on the verge of doing something really big on their own, and he teamed up with that. But ultimately, the reason the thing I love so much, pro wrestling, has gotten so much better is because there happened to be an eccentric billionaire with wrestling autism, and I'm not joking. Like... Tony Khan has wrestling fucking autism. Jacksonville Jaguars fans, he doesn't care about you. He doesn't care about Fulham. He cares about fucking pro wrestling. I promise you this.
And takes, like, one to know one, if I may.
And it, but, like, that concept is, like, it shows that, like, we're actually not in a free market, right? Like, it's literally just, like, the whims of the elite. And it's like, this family could make a party like that happen instantly, literally just because they wanted it to. That's all it takes is, like, for something like that to happen, all it takes is a rich person wanting it to happen. And that's how it gets done. And that is so fucking stupid when you see, like, what the resources could be used for. It's almost as though I support a system of government that would take the money from the opera singer birthday party and use that money to help the people in the shelter. And I do realize that means they would have a less expensive birthday party. And I philosophically... I'm okay with that, Greg. I'm okay with it.
Yeah, I think all around people would get over it. One important little note that I wanted to add to the whole conversation about, like, oh, we got our thing rained out, I guess we'll throw a birthday party instead, is the line where the mother talks about, oh, the sky is so beautiful, thank God we got all that rain, no pollution.
Right.
Look how pretty the skies are, and everyone just sulking, everyone that makes below a certain amount is just sulking and miserable because their fucking homes are flooded.
Yeah, dude.
And then they get called into work the next day. Ugh. It's the Ki family, K-I. So we got Ki-Woo, Ki-Jong, Ki-Taek.
Gotcha.
Those are my last little tidbits for you, I guess.
Yeah, man.
Have we done it? Have we successfully parasited?
You know, I was really going to follow your lead and just kind of feel my way through this, so I don't really have anything unsaid that I really wanted to say. Do you?
No, I kind of got through everything. Much like Inglourious Basterds, I just kind of wrote my notes, not while I was watching, but either before the fact or after the fact, and just kind of as a new thought came to mind, I would just pull up the notes and type something else in. But I think I got pretty much through everything. This is I'll get into it later. Whatever. What a great movie. What a picture.
What a picture.
I
we haven't done that.
What a picture. We haven't done that in a while, and we've seen so many pictures deserving of the What a Picture mark.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Denny. We got to stay on theme. We can't stop talking about wrestling.
We got to do it.
What is the diesel spot? What's the diesel spot? What's the diesel spot for Parasite?
Mine just kept evolving. I want to, like, part of me is just like, the third act is the fucking diesel spot. Have you seen that thing? It's like a concentric fluid hole. It all just is like one thing, is the mastery of the third act. It is really hard for me to pick something. I think I am gonna go with I wrote the phrase neck noose rock smash, and I know exactly what that is. That's a runner-up.
Yeah, I know what that
neck
is.
Noose rock smash is a runner-up. I wrote that there was a literal diesel spot at the birthday party where the hero just comes and starts stabbing motherfuckers. I think I'm going to go with that under the table scene. That's what sticks with me most about the movie. That's what stuck with me most on the first watch. And I even wrote in my notes what you already touched on, is that that really mortifyingly scary shot of his feet just being right in view and they could look over there and see them at any time. To me, that was the cherry on top of like a truly, truly memorable scene. And you stuck the fucking landing with a little something like that. You know, it's like structurally that scene was its own horror movie. You know, like there was even a final fake out scare, you know, like that. It was, oh my God. I love the scene where they're all tense and scared under the table so much.
Fantastic. And like texting the daughter. Oh, all good shit.
God.
Mine is, I kind of thought this would come up at some point in our discussion, but I'm kind of glad it didn't, so we didn't spoil it. Mm-hmm. But the fabulous, wonderful, masterful montage of the scheme to get the housekeeper fired.
God.
Is just a filmmaker flexing their muscles. It is so good. It's so amazing. It's just this kinetic, beautiful thing of just a scheme being conceived and being executed all in one, like, consistent, incredible motion. Mm-hmm. It's such a great scene. Like, every little piece of it, like the feel, like you feel the razor blade shaving off the peach fuzz, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing, and just like the little flick onto the back, and it's just, it's this perfect like mix of the sensory and the narrative and like the improvisation of the family to like kind of make this thing work, and the patience.
Mm-hmm.
Right, like they talk about, like, oh, I mentioned a few days ago that, or like I mentioned to my wife, that I saw this woman that looked like a housekeeper at the hospital. And this is like a 7 or 8 minute segment or sequence that takes place narratively over a few days. And we feel like this is all taking place over a couple of hours. Like,
right, it's just,
It's fantastic. The music is great in it. It's so fun to watch. Like, it's just, it's kind of like a microcosm of all their little schemes, but it's the most fun one to watch, and it's the most kinetic and just flows the best. It's fantastic. That's the scene that sticks out to me the most, but I can't deny the amazingment, the amazingness of the family hiding under the table. That shit is,
I mean, like,
white knuckling.
You're basically describing, like, art house Ocean's 11. Like, I'm so glad you said heist movie, because I hadn't quite thought of it in that way. And when you said that, I was like, yeah, they're, like, literally doing, like, you son of a bitch, I'm in type of shit. Like, it's like, it's like a genre'd up heist movie, honestly. Like, it's really leaning into the heist. That, dude, peach shavings. God, what a fucking little device they had in that. That was so cool.
Oh, it's so great. There's just so many. I want to mention, like, every single little tiny thing that this movie does that makes me, like, smirk and say, yeah, movies are cool. But that would take all day. Just watch the movie instead. You'll spot them all yourself. Danny, what's your favorite line from Parasite?
You know, I honestly, I didn't have a lot of powerhouse ones.
Okay.
But one that I stuck with is one that's Kiwu says, I believe, which is, in this setting, do I fit in? It just seemed like a really powerful, it seemed like a core question that the movie asks, expressed through a character's organic dialogue. It's the inverse of the American Psycho Christian Bale, because I want to fit in. It's like seeing the sociopath insane world and being like, can I blend? I'm a little insecure about it, you know? But that one resonated with me. But I didn't really have, like, a huge standout line, per se. What about you?
No, I kind of felt the same way. I felt like all the powerhouse moments are visual in this movie.
Sure.
But one line that I really like, and this kind of ties into the viewing stone for me, or just kind of, like, the family's attitude towards life, is in the gym with K-Tech, talking to Kiwu, and Kiwu asks about, like, hey, you mentioned a plan about the people in the basement. What was it? And Kitek says, Kiwu, you know what kind of plan never fails? No plan at all. No plan. You know why? If you make a plan, life never works out that way. Look around us. Did these people think, let's all spend the night at the gym? But look now. Everyone's sleeping on the floor, us included. That's why people shouldn't make plans. With no plan, nothing can go wrong. And if something spins out of control, it doesn't matter. Whether you kill someone or betray your country, none of it fucking matters. Got it?
Tell it to just my autism.
Awesome nihilistic view. It's just kind of like sums up their whole attitude during the whole movie. I think it's great.
But Greg, the movie ends with him making a plan. The message did not stick, Greg, and that's the tragedy of this wonderful film.
Yeah, I pulled up on, before this call, I pulled it up on HBO Max to kind of make sure I got the line right, because I think, like, on IMDb it's translated a little bit differently. I wanted the one from, like, the subtitles of the movie itself, so I made sure I had that typed out right. And then I wanted to check the shot of the stone going back in the river, and, like, I basically skipped from what I just said, the speech about plans are bullshit, to the end with the stone, and Kiwu was delivering a line that says, like, I have a plan, father. It's like, oh, God, buddy, I don't know.
No, like,
maybe it sounds like you're both kind of wrong. I don't know.
I mean, like, I will say, dude, like, Vanessa and I have lived below the poverty line before. I mean, it's not getting quite like that, but, like, life is really fucking expensive, and we're definitely having to trim back quite a few luxuries, like I think just about everybody in America is having to do right now, because just cost of living has gone up so fucking insane. And I totally forgot why I was going to say this. What were we just talking about?
About the time below the poverty line. What about plans?
Well, that's something that I'm really internalizing right now, which is, first of all, to give you a little peel behind the mental health curtain, people who are actively undergoing trauma can't really think very far in the future, you know, and if if you're just always in that place of stress, of poverty, like that, like just like inescapable poverty, and it's just like essentially constant ongoing trauma for you throughout your whole life, you really can't think very far past breakfast tomorrow. You know, like seriously, like how you're going to get through the next day is usually where your brain's at. But I think that like I'm sitting here being like, what fucking plans? I'm not convinced our financial institutions are going to exist in 5 years. I'm not convinced that if I put money in a 401k right now, that that's going to come back to me one day. I'm very feeling like infrastructure is not just collapsing, but being destroyed around us. And we're becoming increasingly aware of why we needed that infrastructure. And I really am being like, there is no later. There is no plan. The plan is like, ultimately, I'm swept in the current by something bigger than me, and I'm doing my best to swim in it. And that's literally everyone's situation. We're all in the same boat together. But like, how can you plan for the future when you're like, I don't know, bread might cost $40 next year? You know, like, how could you? How can you truly plan for the future? What's it like to be a parent in times like these, Greg? I'm sure it's really soothing.
Oh, I'm not thinking about it.
Yeah, let's not worry about it. See, no plan. The plan is do your best. That's the fucking plan.
The plan is feed him today and also feed him tomorrow.
Okay, you're going to need to do that for the whole week. Just a little crash course on parenting, buddy.
What? Oh, you want to hear something insane?
Sure.
2 weeks from today, he'll be a year old.
No. Like literally not possible.
I'm afraid it is. And if you thought that went by fast, imagine my brain.
You literally called me 3 months ago to tell me that you're about to be a parent. That was 3 months ago.
Yeah, we found out we were pregnant like 6 weeks ago, right?
Yeah, is recently. That how? Yeah. What? That was a year ago?
Yep. He's about to be a year old. That's crazy, pants.
What a year it's been. Incidentally, tomorrow's 11's birthday.
Aww. Yeah.
At the time of recording, she'll be turning 9.
Happy birthday, baby donkey.
She's going to get a peanut butter sandwich. Her favorite. Aww.
And booty slaps.
Oh, dude. Yeah. It scritches. Like, literally, my relationship with 11 is, like, all about scritches right now. There's nothing else she cares about.
And times like these, there's nothing else I care about.
Hell yeah. I'm going to scratch that booty, please. Greg.
All right, well, I'm going to scratch a Critiker score out of you.
Oh, shit, I forgot we weren't done with gimmicks. I was just meandering about. I'm sorry.
No, I was along for the ride.
I gave this a 48 out of 50. It is my first in the series to not get a full 50. To quote Greg Johnson, 5 stars is a feeling, and this just didn't quite get me there for reasons I can't really objectively say. But also, to quote Dave Meltzer, wrestling reviewer, if you say a match is 5 stars and I say it's 4.75 stars, we agree it was an amazing match. Why would we argue about that?
There you go.
You know, and so I'm like, yeah, dude, this is something that, like, is absolutely on the level of everything else we've covered. And, like, when you get to the top of my list, when it's like, you know, that 47 to 50 territory is very vague, undefined, and also all very, very close, you know? Like, a 47 is a lot closer to a 50 than a 37 is to a 40, if you know what I mean, on my rankings.
I do know what you mean. I'm in a pretty similar boat. I gave Parasite a 38 out of 40.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, it's like this kind of undefined nebulous, it's near perfect, it's just kind of a personal taste thing that I can't really put into words, but the fact that it's this high means it's pretty damn good. So yep. 38 out of 40. Love this movie. Glad we got to finally talk about it. All right, Danny, I got to go to bed. So what are we doing next week?
Next week.
What's happening?
We're going to do a poll for Bong Joon-ho movies. Kidding. That's a joke about last week. Next week, we're going to do Martin Scorsese, and this is going to be the first entrant in the Director Royal Rumble, where we will let the audience choose which movie we're going to cover, because, frankly, Scorsese has a lot to cover. There's going to be a lot of options. I'm excited to see how that poll goes, because you know, the difference between Taxi Driver and The Departed is huge, and we could be doing a whole lot of different things next week. I'm excited for the suspense of it all, I suppose.
Hell yeah. A lot of polls going on, folks. And, of course, that means someone's got to leave, too. Mm-hmm, we got to bounce somebody else to make room for old Marty here. So,
you can find all of that on the Instagram, by the way, at Movies for Win. Links to vote. I post the big ones on the Facebook, but part of me wonders if that is, like, even used. It's, like, literally just me and Greg talking to each other on the Facebook sometimes.
Yeah, and Dylan being like, yeah, man, I know. So,
yeah. I've largely moved on from Facebook as a platform. I'm pretty, honestly, our Movies for Win Instagram is like my main form of social media. I'm always fucking with that thing.
Yeah, I think that's the right move for life in general.
I enjoy it.
Yeah, Denny, while you're posting all your bullshit, why don't you go ahead and post a catchphrase?
Oh, man, I didn't have anything funny prepared, so I'll just do a regular one. Yeah. For Greg, the not-so-secret stash, Johnson. What is my thing now? I changed it. I'm not the talent.
I hope the meds work.
Ah, oh, that's right. I'm Denny. Let's hope the meds work, Taylor. And this is I don't think the meds work, Greg. This has been Movies for When. I already told you when. But you know what we didn't tell you? What's my class again? Cage again. I'm in a cage called class. I can't escape from my class. It is a cage. I'm a policeman. See my class?